Coming up, promoting Middle East peace by bringing bereaved Israelis and Palestinians together to share their pain.
They are giving a message of hope in the midst of hopelessness in the Holy Land.
And as the healthcare debate intensifies, religious leaders weigh in.
There's no issue confronting America that raises the issue of justice more than the challenge for universal coverage.
Plus, the art and, for many, the real purpose of stained glass.
If the stained glass is well-designed and well-executed, it's going to lift your mind to God.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Protests continued in Iran following the disputed presidential election. This week, more than 50 American religious leaders called on Iran to stop the violence between police and demonstrators. In a letter addressed to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the group said violence waged in the name of Islam slanders the religion. They quoted from the Quran to urge peace. The interfaith group included U.S. Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Meanwhile, the international Baha'i community says seven Iranian Baha'i leaders are scheduled to stand trial on July 11th. The seven are virtually the entire Baha'i leadership in Iran. They were arrested in 2008 and charged with spying for Israel, which is punishable by death. Human rights activists say the charges are false and are calling for the leaders' acquittal. The Baha'i faith began in the 19th century in what is now Iran. The French Parliament has created a commission to study whether the Muslim burqa deprives women of freedom and dignity. This week, French President Nicolas Sarkozy delivered a critical speech saying the Islamic dress imprisons women, and such garments are not welcome in France. With an estimated 5 million Muslims, France is home to Western Europe's largest Muslim population. In this country, conservatives who have left the Episcopal Church because of disputes over homosexuality and other issues now have their own church. The Anglican Church in North America was formally launched this week. The group installed Robert Duncan, the former Episcopal Bishop of Pittsburgh, as its archbishop. The new body says it has some 100,000 members in 700 parishes across the U.S. and Canada. It hopes to be affiliated with the worldwide Anglican Communion, but traditionally the Communion has only one jurisdiction in any given region, and here that is the Episcopal Church. The Archbishop of Canterbury, spiritual head of the Communion, has not recognized the new church so far. It's a common observation that one of the most important paths to peace between enemies is to learn to see others not as demonized stereotypes, but as unique human beings. When she was in the Middle East last month, Kim Lawton learned about the Parents Circle Families Forum, Israeli Jews and Palestinian Muslims who have lost loved ones in their long conflict, but have learned to replace hate with reconciliation, even friendship. Here is Kim's special report.
Since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, Palestinian refugee camps in the West Bank have been hotbeds of unrest and often scenes of angry confrontation between displaced Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. Because of the continuing military and political conflict, few Israeli civilians ever venture in. But don't tell that to Rami Elhanan. On this day, he and his wife, Nurit, have come to the Dehesa refugee camp near Bethlehem to visit their friend, Mazen Faraj. It's an unexpected friendship. Both have lost family members in the conflict, yet their grief has brought them together.
Today, it's our responsibility for our children and for our families to build something new. We put a crack in this wall of hatred and fear that divide these two nations. And we show another way. We show another possibility. We show the ability to listen to each other's pain, which is essential if you want to get to any kind of reconciliation.
And this was the first room for our house.
Farage has lived in Dehesa his entire life. During the early part of his childhood, 15 people in his family lived in this one crowded room.
This is the place he's always talking about, that you don't need someone to hate you, to teach you how to hate when you grow up in a room like this.
In April of 2002, there was a violent confrontation between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian fighters outside Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity, the site where Christian tradition holds that Jesus was born. Palestinian fighters holed up in the church, and Israeli soldiers laid siege. During a lull in the fighting, Farage's 62-year-old father went out to Jerusalem to get groceries. He was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers.
He got killed in April 2002 when he was coming back from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. The Israeli soldier, they started shooting him without any reason. No one can kill his soul. They succeeded to kill his body, but without his soul. His soul still around us and give us like the power every day how to keep going in our lives.
But there is great pain on the Israeli side as well. Elhanan had a 14-year-old daughter, Smadar. Of four children, she was the only daughter, and the family called her the princess. On September 4th, 1997, the first day of school, Smadar went to a popular shopping area in Jerusalem.
She went down the street with her girlfriends to buy new books for the new year. Two suicide bombers blew themselves up, killing five people that day, including three little girls. One of them was my 14-year-old Smadar.
Elhanan says he was overwhelmed by anger and despair.
It took me almost a year to understand who I am, to try to recover, and to understand that I have to choose a way for myself and translate these feelings of anger and despair into something constructive and create some hope out of it. And I joined the parent circle, and I found a meaning for my life.
The Parent Circle Families Forum was launched in 1995 as a way to bring bereaved Israelis and Palestinians together. The group now has several hundred participants who've lost immediate family members because of the violence in this region. Organizers believe it's the only project of its kind in an area where conflict is still ongoing.
The nonprofit group sponsors face-to-face dialogue meetings for bereaved family members and public lectures about reconciliation.
The minute I saw in that meeting the first bereaved Palestinian families as human beings, I was completely shocked. It was the first time ever in my life that I met Palestinians as human beings after so many years of demonizing each other. So this was the turning point.
Farage, who was dealing with his own feelings of anger and revenge, went to one parent circle meeting where Elhanan spoke.
And it was this man talking about his suffering and his pain too. But I told him, what do you know about suffering and pain? You just live in Jerusalem. You are Israel. You are the occupier. You are everything. And then he started to talk about his daughter. And then I found out that, well, it's the same pain.
The two men became close friends. Elhanan was drawn by Farage's humor.
He's the only guy in the world that makes me laugh.
Farage couldn't believe that Elhanan was willing to visit him in the refugee camp. They built a deep mutual respect.
He's just a human being, and you can deal with him in an easy way, and you can build a discussion with him with easy way, and you can build the fight also in easy way too. But the most important thing is that he respects the other.
What he's doing needs a lot of guts, and his ability to face the world, tell his truth after all the things that he's been through. I think it's admirable, and I really respect him for it.
Farage and Elhanan started doing joint lectures for the parent circle.
We use this enormous respect that the two societies have for people who paid the highest price possible to convey this message, to convey the message of dialogue, of reconciliation, of peace.
Al-Hanan and Faraj have given more than 1,000 joint lectures in Palestinian and Israeli schools. They say most of the kids have no idea that Palestinians and Israelis can be friends.
If there is only one kid at the end of the class who nods his head with acceptance to this message, we saved one drop of blood. According to Judaism, this is the whole world.
The parent circle is non-sectarian, but it is supported by several Muslim, Christian, and Jewish groups. In 2008, Catholic Relief Services brought Faraj and Al-Hanan on a speaking tour across the United States.
They are giving a message of hope in the midst of hopelessness in the Holy Land. So we thought that this would be a strong message to bring to our U.S. Catholic audiences.
For their part, Al-Hanan and Faraj try to keep the focus on relationship, not religion.
It's the important things that we don't want to make this conflict like a religion conflict.
Their work isn't always easy. Both men have received sometimes strong criticism from within their respective communities.
People tell me that I'm a traitor, but I think more people are impressed by my ability to translate the pain into hope.
I really believe in what I'm doing, but not all the people, they really accept that. But anyway, if you believe in something, you have to continue.
Parent Circle supporters hope these relationships can be a model for others, which they believe will help further the political peace process.
By building trust with each other, they become more and more ready to trust the other side, to compromise, and to tell their leaders that they are ready, that they can move ahead, they can compromise, and they can sign the peace agreements.
Faraj and Al-Hanan agree.
We have a different culture and different religion and different also conditions on the ground too. So how we can find a way? This is the problem. It's not about, that's it, I found the solution for the conflict. No, but the first step, we have to know each other.
And devote my life to go everywhere possible to tell the very simple truth that we are not doomed. It's not a destiny to keep on killing each other. And we can stop it by talking to one another. That simple.
Simple in theory, much more elusive to work out. But they hope their relationship proves it is possible. I'm Kim Lawton in the West Bank.
During a trip to Europe next month, President Obama will have an audience with Pope Benedict XVI. The White House says the two will discuss a range of issues, including, quote, their shared belief in the dignity of all people. The Vatican scheduled a rare afternoon audience to accommodate Obama's travel schedule. This week, the president hosted a White House meeting with congressional leaders working on immigration reform. Meanwhile, several religious groups are advocating action. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops urged Congress and the administration to change immigration policy by the end of the year. And as Obama also pushed health care reform, a coalition of religious leaders joined the effort with a rally and interfaith prayer service in Washington. The event brought together Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Jews, and others who called for universal and affordable health care. The group said health care is a moral issue and called the nation's current situation too immoral to tolerate. One of the participants in that interfaith coalition is Sister Simone Campbell, Executive Director of NETWRC, a national Catholic social justice lobby. Her order is the Sisters of Social Service. She is also a lawyer. Sister, welcome.
Thank you.
In that coalition, your number one priority is expanding health care for everyone. Talk about that.
It's a shocking outrage in our country. It's a moral outrage that we have almost 50 million people without coverage, without access to a doctor, and we have even hundreds of thousands more that can't even use the coverage that they have. That's wrong. We have to change it.
Mm-hmm. Hard as that is, perhaps, to change, even harder is trying to figure out how to pay for what we're doing.
Well, we have to be responsible and pay for it, but there's lots of savings in the system. There's administrative savings, streamlining processes, electronic filing. There's controls of costly expenditures, planning for where high capital equipment gets installed. And there's ways of saving on expenditures for services also.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that, especially for older people. We read that there is just a whole lot of stuff that is prescribed and ordered that, at least in retrospect, looks as if it wasn't really necessary, and that the biggest savings are in what's done for people in the last part of their lives.
Well, that is a significant area of savings. There's a lot of evidence that the fear of dying keeps us holding on to life in such ways that extraordinary means get used on a regular basis, and that makes it really challenging for limiting costs. There are other places where cost savings can be obtained, too, but that's a big one. Mm-hmm.
You've said that we need to get real about dying. Is that what you're talking about, accepting it?
Yes.
But how can you expect somebody to do that? You know, maybe another procedure will help.
And maybe it will. And that's the hard part. But culturally, as a nation, we do not see death as integrated with living. We see it as something that's to be feared. We're getting better at it. But with the hospice programs and other programs, but we as a culture need to accept dying as part of living, and it's integrated, it's one piece. And I, as a person of faith, know it's not the worst thing that can happen to you.
It's pretty hard to convince the family of somebody who's very sick that you shouldn't do everything possible to help them.
I think there's a question in between quality of life and what does it mean to do everything possible. If pain, when you see your loved one in pain, yes, it's hard. But what are the choices? I think we have to be responsible in making those choices, and that just because it can be done doesn't mean it must be done.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it would be better off if doctors were on salary rather than fee-for-service?
There's a lot of evidence that there's better health outcomes, that patients are happier when doctors get a salary and don't have the incentive to prescribe additional treatment or to do just one more test. The real issue, healthcare is about nurturing the whole person, making the whole person well. And doctors need to take that into consideration, not just the money they make.
And very quickly, are we going to get a bill this year? Are we going to get a law change this year?
I think we've got a great chance it's moving, but it's going to be up to us, we the people, to insist that it happen. We've gone too long without it. We need to make it happen now.
Mm-hmm. Sister Simone Campbell, many thanks.
Thank you.
Finally, we have a story about the art of making a stained glass window, an art that enriched cathedrals long ago and is still very much alive today. Bob Faw has a report on a stained glass artist in Florida who talks about how a window is made and why.
In his Orlando, Florida studio, Jim Piercy, along with a handful of skilled artisans, carries on a 1,500-year-old tradition, creating, indeed celebrating with color and glass, not just beautiful stained glass windows, but something more.
People have told me that my windows have helped them come closer to God. And that's, you know, if that's what my windows do, then I consider the window a success.
Stained glass, that is glass painted, then fired, which has graced the great cathedrals and private chapels. Stained glass enriches an inner life, said one historian, with its own richness. Since 1981, Jim Piercy has completed nearly 400 works of stained glass, from a chapel in a wooded retreat to a Sunday school in a community started by Walt Disney to this spectacular rose window in St. Michael's Episcopal Church in Orlando.
The objective is, of course, in all things to glorify God, but also to use it as a teaching vessel.
So many biblical stories in these windows, some well-known, others less so, that every week Father Hamilton brings preschoolers here to study.
We see, for example, also that wonderful story of Rahab lowering the spies of Israel out of Jericho, you know, and saving their lives.
To be successful, Jim Piercy says a stained glass window must fit with the personality of its church. But according to art historian Richard Gross, stained glass, which truly succeeds, can do far more.
If the stained glass is well designed and well executed, it's going to lift your mind to God and provide a way to encounter God and to grow in spirituality and in understanding of the Christian faith.
The process of making stained glass is painstaking, even tedious. For Jim Piercy, it begins at the drafting table, making a cartoon.
So basically, making a cartoon is drafting a full-size drawing. So if we're doing a window 20 feet by 20 feet, I have to draft it 20 feet by 20 feet.
Much, of course, depends on the glass itself. Piercy's is all hand-blown in Germany, selected not just for its color, but for whether it will transmit light directly or spread it.
But this glass is totally transparent. This glass is translucent. This is really good to use if you want to obscure a view, like a parking lot or a McDonald's across the street from the church.
From the glass that is selected, every piece is sectioned and numbered to match a corresponding number on the drawing or cartoon. The glass then carefully painted.
This glass is being stained. These are actually called glass painter stains.
Then into a furnace or kiln, heated precisely to 1250 degrees, where paint fuses onto the glass.
Once this glass comes out of the kiln and it's cooled, that's permanent. I mean, it's there for 800 years.
Later, as he's done for the last 58 years, Helmut Schart glazes the panel using pliable lead strips to piece the sections of glass together.
The lead is shaped like an H, and it has channels on either side. The channels receive the glass.
Finally, the panels are covered with sawdust, a mild abrasive, and are buffed or polished to a brilliant sheen.
Because it's mouth-blown, handmade glass, these striations makes that piece of glass sparkle.
Completed, Piercy's stained glass does more than dazzle. At Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Lake Mary, Florida, parishioners asked him to create a dove, not descending, as in most church windows, but ascending.
The idea would be that as you look at the dove, your eyes would go up. When we think of the dove going up, we think of the spirit of man, and that spirit connected with the Holy Spirit, ultimately connected for eternity with the Spirit of God.
What Piercy has done here, says Hoyer, is to encourage worship.
And this is where I like to pray. I like to sit right in the very center where I can see all of the glass. The presence of God comes to me in that way. For me personally, it's just a great worship experience.
In all his stained glass, there are similarities, each very labor-intensive and time-consuming. But each window is unique. And while some symbols are traditional, a lion for the Apostle Mark, an ox for Luke, those doves are another matter. Jim Piercy has done hundreds of them, and each one is different.
You can depict a dove like it's almost a photograph, or you can abstract a dove to where you can barely tell that it's a dove. While they're thinking about that dove, what that dove is doing to them is taking their mind away from the economy, from political situations. It just gives them a brief moment in time where they can contemplate something greater than they are.
All this from what began as a hobby for a 62-year-old former high school biology and chemistry teacher who was raised as a Rock Rib Methodist and who will tell you that though he is unaffiliated with any denomination, he, like his work, has evolved spiritually.
And you said your windows allow people to have access to something greater than themselves.
Yeah.
That's the way you see what you do.
I would say a lot of my work is spiritual. I'm spiritual because I'm not preaching. You know, I'm not proselytizing. What I try to do is interpret what their faith says.
You see the windows as being almost fulfilling a kind of priestly function, I gather.
For a lot of artists, liturgical artists, stained glass or sculpture or tapestries, it's their ministry.
Yes, it can be enormously expensive, and lead, so essential here, is widely considered an environmental hazard. But those who uphold the tradition say the practice of making stained glass is flourishing now, and that it always will.
People want to surround themselves with beauty. So just as churches will continue to have all sorts of religious art, stained glass will be a major part of that.
And if stained glass no longer holds the same exalted role that it held in the Middle Ages, both then and now, it continues to teach, to inspire, to soothe, even to look beyond.
That sunlight comes through those colors with all the texture and the striations and seeds and reams of stained glass. Nothing matches it in beauty.
Especially in the loving hands of someone for whom all this is more than just pieces of glass. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faw in Orlando, Florida.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more from the healthcare reform rally and interfaith prayer service in Washington.
Spirit revives my soul.